and Filippo. So the talk will consist out of two not very connected parts. So in part one, I will just review some line and surface operators just to motivate the second part of the talk. So first, I will give like a very brief review of Wilson and Hooft line operators. Then I will give review of some type of surface operators in N equals 4 Young Mills theory. And then I will mention that they can be thought, it's sometimes useful to think of, in at least in N equals 4, it's useful to think of line and surface operators as D-brains. And that's the attitude I'm going to take when I go to the second part of my talk. I will start with a system of D-brains and see what kind of non-local operator I can derive from the system. So I will choose the system of D3 and D7 brains intersecting along a surface. So it will give rise to some surface operator. So I will review the system, what the symmetry, supersymmetries, and other stuff. And then it will turn out that the field theory it will it well it will turn out that it will have that the system is non-trivial in the sense that it cannot be nicely formulated in flat space. So I'll have to go away from flat space. So I'll have to introduce some non-trivial background. And I'll have to study field theory in this non-trivial background. And then I will derive the surface operator in this theory. And the last part will be the supergravity description of the same D3, D7 system. And so I will talk about some leading order approximation, which is the probe approximation. And then I will talk about the supergravity solution beyond the probe approximation. And the outcome of it, if you are not in some sense, has nothing to do with surface operator. So the outcome you can view as follows. So this procedure which I will follow will lead to a holographic duality beyond field theory in flat space. So the background will be non-flat, and it will be consistent with the supergravity solution. And for the and from the other viewpoint is that for this D3 D7 system, we have solved the problem of back reaction. So we can think that we have D3 brain on which N equals 4 Young Mills lives, then we add some D7 brains and intersect in a certain way. They start back reacting, and the question how they back react. And I would say that we solved this problem both in field theory and supergravity, which means we took into account terms of order lambda m over n. So it's some set of 1 over n corrections, not all of them, of course. So let me start with the review of line and surface operators to just to motivate the work in this direction. So the line operators are known to be useful to study phase structure of gauge theory. So gauge theories can be in various phases, which I wrote here, like confining, deconfining, Coulomb branch, Coulomb, Higgs, free electric and magnetic. And line operator is something that can distinguish them. So you basically study the response of a gauge field when you insert some probe, heavy particles like electrically or magnetically charged, and the particle has a world line, and you have some non-local operator, which is a line operator. So the well-known operator is the Wilson line operator, which is given by some simple expression, well, relatively simple expression. And so L is the world line of a particle, of a electrically, in this case, charged particle. And R is the representation. So in general, the Wilson line operators are labeled by representations of the gauge group. And this type of operators is called order type operator, which means it's constructed out of the fields which are presented in the Lagrangian, like the gauge field. And it served as an order parameter. So there are some known examples how it behaves for at least for when L is a large loop. So, for example, in the Higgs phase, it basically gives a perimeter law, which means that for when the loop is large, then because there are massive, the interaction is due to massive particles, the electric charge is screened to some extent, and the potential is approximately constant, which gives rise to the perimeter law. And another important example is the area law, which exists in the confining phase. So in this case, the interaction of electric particles is due to an electric flux tube, which basically the potential grows with the distance, and it gives rise to the area law. So when you look for the equations of motion for the gauge field, you'll see that this term gives a delta functional type contribution localized along the line. And so charged particles, I mean, one can always think of them as of a source. And this motivates introduction of another type of line operators, which are called disorder type operators. They are not defined by using fields and the Lagrangian, but instead they're defined by postulating some singular behavior of the gauge field and or other fields near a certain line. An example of them is the Tuft operator. The Tuft operator is defined as the evaluating of the path integral under assumption that, under condition that all gauge fields have a singularity of a magnetic, that all gauge fields have a singularity of a magnetic monopole near the line x equals zero. So this line is localized in time. So you can view it as a world line of a magnetic monopole. So the coefficient m in the abelian case is just the charge, the magnetic charge. In the non-abelian case, it's useful to think in the non-abelian case, it's reasonable to view it as an element of the Cartan subalgebra corresponding to the gauge group G. And and it's interesting question how to how you label them. And it turns out for various reasons, they are also labeled. You can also label the Tuft operator by representation, but it turns out the not of the original group G, but in general some other group which is called Langlands dual. So the basically Tuft operators are also labeled by representations. So if G is UN, then in this case the Langlands dual group is also UN. M is just the diagonal, matrix whose entries can be taken to be positive. And this kind of matrix can be thought as the highest weight of the representation of the gauge group, and that's basically how you label them. And as I said before, for the Wilson loop, behaves as a sort of perimeter law in the Higgs phase and area law in the confining phase. And for the Tuft loop, this behavior is reversed. In confining phase can be thought in some sense as a condensation of monopoles. So for monopoles, now the magnetic charge basically is screened, and we have the perimeter law. However, in the Higgs phase, you produce something like a cosmic type string, which can confine monopoles, which are like magnetic flux tubes, and confine monopoles, and the behavior is like the area law. So there is some, so the Tuft's idea was that it might be easy to understand confinement by studying Tuft's loop. Nevertheless, however, it's known that line operators are not enough to distinguish all the phases. There are explicit examples where you can, in principle, study when there is a theory with lots of branches, and it turns out there are branches with the same basically behavior, Wilson and Tuft operators, but they are not really the same. So the outcome. I gave this review to motivate that really more parameters are needed. And so the next thing, then it's a natural thing. What's the natural thing to do is to insert now a string-like object, which gives rise to the concept of surface operator. So a surface now will be a world sheet, basically spanned by a string. However, currently it's not known whether surface operators are order parameters, and I won't be able to answer this question at this moment. But it seems that there is a natural reason to study them, to eventually understand whether they are order parameters and whether they can, whether they have some interesting behavior in various phases. So from now I will consider n equals 4 UN gauge theory, and I will give a review of some surface operators of disorder type introduced by Gukov and Witten. So they defined a surface operator again of disorder type by postulating that the gauge field has a behavior of basically cosmic string. So it's near the plane z equals z bar equals 0. A is basically the angular component is a constant, which means that the gauge field is like the delta, the field strength is like the delta function. So in more detail, well, there is some coefficient. You have to specify the coefficient, and in general, the coefficient is when you diagonalize it is of this type. So the gauge group will be broken, and there are some eigenvalues, m of them. Let's say m of them, and a surface operator then is parameterized by how the gauge group is broken by these numbers ni. Sorry?
Can you go to the back?
Yes.
So you're saying u is some line operator of a around?
Well, when you diagonalize a, you can bring it to this form. So it will be parameterized by parameters alpha and how the gauge group is broken.
But U is defined by integrating all the
yes.
parameters.
Yes, you can define, yes, in some sense specified by the element U of UN, which is like the polynomial. But you don't have to think about this, just think this way. Then it's just, you diagonalize it in the matrix of this form that multiplies the angle. So as I was saying, the parameters will be how the gauge group is broken, this n i's. Then there are those alpha i's, the coefficients. And it turns out under S duality, they transform nicely with the theta angles for each unbroken u1. This is all in Gukov and Witten, so it's not going to be important for me. Just for I just want to tell you what really parameterizes the operators. And in addition, one can study the behavior of the scalar fields. So there are several reasons. For me, it will be just to make the operator supersymmetric. So let's out of six scalars, single out just two of them and postulate this kind of behavior near z equals zero. So the scalar fields now are complex, so I can introduce the imaginary and the real part. And they also transform nicely under S duality, but it's not important for me. So at the end, to summarize, the parameters are the unbroken gauge group with parameters ni, parameterized by ni, and there are various parameters corresponding to the singular behavior of the gauge field and the scalars. So this operator has some symmetries. There are bosonic symmetries, there are some Poincaré. Yeah.
To scale, yes. You picked out two of them.
Yes.
Well, I mean, couldn't you put interesting boundary conditions on the other scalars as well, or what happens then?
Well, my definition of the operator I want to study, I want to choose is this.
Yeah.
But the question whether can you keep them supersymmetric, I don't know, maybe it is.
Oh, so this is a natural set of boundary conditions,
yes,
that are supersymmetric.
Yes, right.
If I do these other things, they may or may not produce something.
Right. Yeah, so when you study this kind of operators, it's useful to track the symmetry. So this one preserves some various symmetries, like rotating on the scalars, right? Like there is some formal group in two dimensions. There is some U1, and there are some supersymmetries also. So it turns out to be half BPS, and it also preserves half of superconformal supersymmetries. But if you look at this, all the symmetries and the supersymmetry condition, you see that it looks very similar to what kind of to supersymmetry is preserved by various D-brains. And it turns out that, yes, this kind of operators preserve the same symmetries and supersymmetries as the system of intercepting D3 brains of D3, D3 brains intersecting along a surface. So you can view this surface operator in some sense as a set of D brains. So one D3 stack of D3 brains is like n equals 4. And then there is one more stack intersecting it along the surface. And this leads, and this is equivalent to saying that you are doing path integral n equals 4 in the presence of this weird operator.
Can see the time direction in the projection condition.
Completely. Does it really matter here? No, I don't think it's necessary.
Shouldn't you have had the time direction in the projection condition then?
No, the intersection. Oh, okay, I see. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the. Yeah, let's think. Let's stop it. I don't think they have to be clear here. So what the system of D brains, as I said, can be chosen to be as follows. So there is some n equals 4 D3 brain, and there is the second set. So I'm being kind of sloppy here. To be more precise, you really have to say that there is a near horizon. There is AGS 5 process 5 produced by D3 brain. And there is another brain, it's like a probe, or not necessarily probe, in this AGS 5 process 5, which can then back react and you produce some kind of bubbling geometry. But for simplicity, let me just say that you have it's equivalent to saying that there is a system of D brains. And it's useful from two viewpoints to think this way, from two viewpoints. One viewpoint is that it's for study, for example, various supergravity dools. And the second viewpoint why it's useful is because when you quantize the system, you can see that on the intersection, there are some degrees of freedom which you may tend to integrate and think that the surface operator is what you get after you, in some sense, integrate the degrees of freedom.
BPS, but I thought you told me that these surface operators are half BPS.
Oh, well, yeah, these ones are half BPS, yes. Because in the near horizon limit here, you get two axis. So the near horizon limit is not very simple, that's what I'm saying, I'm being kind of sloppy here. So the supergravity solution for the system is very complicated, and it's not known how to take the near horizon limit from it, really. Yeah, so similar results exist really for Wilson loops. So let me just, for completeness, sort of state it. So if you a Wilson loop can be thought basically as a D3 brain plus a fundamental string in it. When the number of strings become large, you can expect some kind of giant Wilson loop, sort of like a giant gravity analogy. So and there are the following results that sort of have been obtained. So if you insert the Wilson line in the K, symmetric or anti-symmetric representation can be thought as the system of D3 or D3, D5 brains intersecting along the line. So there's a string here with additional K units on the fundamental string charge. So from now on, I want to take this attitude. I want to start with the system of D brains and see what I can get. So I'm interested in surface operators, so I want to take a system of D brains intersecting along the surface. So I will take D3, D7 system intersecting along the surface parameterized by x, 0, x plus, or x plus minus. And there are the seven brains which are in the following directions. So I will view again the D3 brains as n equals 4 and means plus there are some D7 brains. And I want to see what kind of what properties the system has. So since they intersect along the surface, I expect that it's really the same as n equals 4 with the addition of the surface operator. So then you can study supersymmetries and find some common solution for this or this. And I want to reformulate everything in terms of the four-dimensional language. From the four-dimensional language, supersymmetry preserved by D3 brains is just a Dirac spinner, four Dirac spinners. This is like the usual Majorana spinner in four dimensions, with an extra index I, which is like 1, 2, 3, 3, 4. And then the the addition of the 7 breaks restricts this epsilon alpha, and the restriction is extremely simple. So it's given by this equation, they are equivalent, they give the same solution. And the solution is basically epsilon 1 equals epsilon 2. So index alpha is like the spinner index 1 or 2, and epsilon 1 equals epsilon 2. That's what the 7 brains do. So, and the outcome, so we are dealing with the gauge theory in 4 dimensions with a 2-dimensional defect, and it has to preserve 8 Poincaré supercharges with this condition. So the superconformal supersymmetry is another story. I will talk about it. So we are interested in the decoupling limit, so to decouple everything we can, which we don't like. And so there is the naive action has n equals 4 piece, and it also has some something on the defect, and the degree of freedom in the defect in this case is the chiral fermion in some representation. And this system, this section is supersymmetric under these supersymmetries. So because the variation of the gauge field proportional to the sigma matrix, and delta A plus is exactly 0 because sigma A plus on epsilon is 0. So the action is invariant under 8 Poincaré supercharges. However, the theory is anomalous, and that's where it gets interesting. Yeah.
You showed in the previous slide. Yes. What happened to the bosons, the traditional ones? So you just have a fermionic additional piece that's just a.
So the degree of freedom in the intersection is just one kind of fermion, that's all. So as I said, the theory is anomalous, so it's convenient to split UN into SUN cross U1, the same for UM. So I will call the capital A's corresponding to the SU part and little A's corresponding to the abelian part. So let's consider first the SUN cross SUM. So we have N corresponds to the number of D3 brains, M is the number of D7 brains. So under gauge transformations, the effective action is known to transform in the following way. So it's like L times DA. So I'm not writing the indices here. But the U1 cross U1 transformation is more complicated. So as you see it, so the chiral fermion couples to the difference because of the M bar, to the difference of these two fields. And therefore the variation is more complicated, contains cross terms. And so there is a difference in the cancellation mechanism. So the usual story is that anomalies are canceled by the inflow mechanism. So in fact, so what this means is that in the D3 brain action, we have to look really at the Born infield action. There is a coupling to some flux produced in this case by the D7 brain. And on the D7 brain world volume, there is the flux produced by the D3 brains. And when you vary this all, so when you vary it under the gauge transformations, the Chern-Simons form is D of something, then you move D here, but D of G is not 0 because of the sources. And as the result, you obtain that the variation of the Chern-Simons forms exactly cancels the anomaly of the Dirac operator as corresponding to the gauge groups SUN cross SUM. However, for U1, it's not going to work like this. And in fact, Itzhaki, Kutasov, and Seiberg suggested that there must be more terms, well, in the different context, but adopting to this case, there must be two more different terms like this, corresponding to cross terms like A of n equals four times something of f tilde, which comes from D7 brains. And I don't think there exists a way that it's known how to derive it from the first principles. But the anomaly basically says anomaly cancellation requires that such terms exist. So you can think of it that A couples to some weird tree form, which is like G1 produced by the D7 brain times F tilde. And then the anomaly really cancels. So that's the mechanism of canceling anomalies. However, this kind of terms which we add, all these Chern-Simons terms, they break supersymmetry. So how is it consistent then? So we canceled anomaly, we broke supersymmetry. Well, the resolution to it seems to me that there's only one possible resolution. when we took into account the flux produced by G7 brains, this flux G1, it's really of order of G string or G Young Mill squared. So therefore, we are really taking the back reaction of the G7 brains, though we do not think this way. So consistency to me requires that we also have to take into account the back reaction of everything which produces by G7 brains, which is like the metric, dilaton, everything. Everything has to be taken into account. And as the result, we have to consider n equals 4 and Mills theory in the G7 brain background. Otherwise, it's not really, it does not seem consistent.
Yes. That's a 10-dimensional background.
Well, some backgrounds have to restrict it to the world order.
But you're going to explain on the next transfer.
Well, yes.
Okay.
So, yeah, the background basically means we restrict it to the world order. We study n equals 4 really in the background. That's a well-defined statement, I think.
And you mentioned that probably what you're going to say is that it's no longer the Minkowski space.
It's no longer Minkowski space. The dilaton does not stand for
so how should I interpret it so that I cannot introduce a surface operator of the type
right. You
mentioned to begin with just in the plain Minkowski n equal 4?
Yes, I will say yes.
Without breaking supersymmetry.
Yes. So let me then now review what the G7 brain background is. So the G7 brain background is given by some metric, some dilaton, and some axion. So the best way to think of it, you introduce the axion plus I dilaton as we call it tau, and tau is holomorphic, and whatever appears here is the imaginary part of tau, and the dilaton is also imaginary part of tau. So here x0, x1, so here I split coordinate in such a way that that's where G7 brain will intersect G3. This is transverse to this also a part of G3, and this is transverse to the G3 brain. So the background is supersymmetric; it preserves some 16 supercharges. And so the simplest solution which you can write with all these properties is the logarithmic tau, but this solution has a problem. So because if e to the minus 5 has to be positive definite, but from here you see it's not. It's positive definite only for small r. So you should view the solution only as a local solution near the brain. Well, let me also mention that there exists a solution to this problem. There exists a global version of it, and the global version is conceptually not very, very difficult to understand. So let's switch to Einstein frame, where the SL to Z duality of type 2BX in a simpler way. And the Einstein frame means we get rid of, we replace this with 1. And replace this one half also with 1. So the metric doesn't transform in this in the Einstein frame, and that's why it's useful. And then we know we know the tau is that the axion dilaton is defined up to SL to Z action, and we know that the imaginary part is e to the minus the dilaton, so it's positive. And tau therefore takes values in the fundamental domain, like the upper half plane minus basically the SL to Z. Minus the SL to Z action. So to find a global solution conceptually is simple. If you can manage to construct a one-to-one map from this fundamental domain to the complex plane, then you just take any holomorphic or meromorphic function on the complex plane and act with J minus 1. And it's known what the one-to-one map is. It's given in terms of some theta function and the eta function, which is not very important for us. And then the any D brain solution is given by some, in general, meromorphic function on the complex plane. So for and different choices of this meromorphic function correspond to different D7 brain solutions. So for a stack of m D7 brains at z equals 0, the solution, the g of z is really taken to be this. So there is some constant related to the value of the dilaton at infinity. There is some other constant related to what I call tau zero here. And there is 1 over z to the power m. And then you act on this g with the j minus 1. That's the solution. So the global solution is known. And that's how the axion dilaton will look like. So the metric. The metric is, turns out, conceptually is also kind of simple. So all you do, you insert holomorphic and anti-holomorphic functions, f and f bar. Locally, it makes no difference. Because locally, you can always go to the coordinate system, and this is just dz prime. So all local invariants, like curvature and so on, cannot change. But globally, this kind of transformation can lead to a singularity. And so you have to demand that this is really invariant under cell to z. And the solution was found by these people, which were written before, Yao, Waffa, Green, Shapiro. And however, you can't really get rid of singularities this way. The metric still has singularities. So it will have a singularity at the position of the D7 brain, and it has conical singularities at infinity. Well, some fun stuff happens when M is large, but let me ignore it. And in all equations which I write later, I will be writing the solution in the local form, but the generalization is what I just explained. So now what we really want. We want a theory on n D3 brains in the background of the D7 brain, so we pull it back onto the D3 brain. So it looks like this, it's a four-dimensional. The function h is like what I reviewed locally. Well, globally, it's also understood now what to do. And tau is holomorphic. And the parameter epsilon has to satisfy this condition. Now, epsilon is just the four-dimensional Majorana spinner, very simple. And there is also the condition that has to be kind of covariantly constant. So from 10-dimensional viewpoint, it comes from the Gravitino variation. You have to set to zero the Gravitino variation. So it's proportional to the flux. And D depends on the spin connection of this metric. That's what we want. So in principle, there exists a procedure how you construct D brain action in any supersymmetric background, but practically it's crazy. So practically it's easier to guess what you write or use it as a guide, sorry, but guess pretty much what you want, what you can write, and check supersymmetry and hope to get lucky. So, but let me outline anyway the procedure, how it roughly goes. It basically guarantees, it's guaranteed in some sense as an existence proof that you will get a supersymmetric action on a single D brain in arbitrary supersymmetric background. And it looks basically as follows. There are these brain actions in curved superspace background, which are crazy, with lots of extra gauge symmetries which have to be fixed. And you basically, then you have to start fixing them. You fix diffeomorphisms by choosing some static gauge. You fix some extra supersymmetries, which will give you 16 fermions, which you identify with gluiness. And since we are interested in the decoupling limit, we basically cut the action at the quadratic level. That's roughly the procedure. But this is like crazy. So the actions look like, crazy if you saw them. But anyway, as a guide, this procedure is not that bad. So let me now basically say what the action is. So we start with the gauge field. So with the gauge field, it's easy what you can write. You can either have a kinetic term. Yes. So here I'm working in the string frame. So that's the most thing. It's the best thing to do. Work really in the string frame. It's less confusing. So and then in the string frame there is a kinetic term for the gauge field, and there is this coupling to the flux produced by the D7 brain to the axion. So we know that there exists non-trivial axion and non-trivial dilaton, so then the complex object constructed of them is holomorphic. And that's important for supersymmetry. So there are some constant here corresponding to the D3 brain tension, but which we eventually identify with the gauge coupling. Now let me describe the scalars, because it's
I can't follow the equations, obviously. It's a lot of it. So this is a two-dimensional defect in the four-dimensional. The metric, how does it behave as you move perpendicular to the defect far away? Does the metric go to flat space if I move perpendicular to the D-brain? The defect?
Does it? No, I don't think so. It's a D7 brain metric, so it will have a conical singularity.
Well, I move in the four-dimensional space,
perpendicular
to the defect, far away from the defect.
So the defect is at z parametrized by flux x minus. So you move far away from the defect, so you move in the z direction.
I can't see, but there you go. Yeah.
And H7 will have a conical singularity, I think. Because it's the D7 brain.
But in the
so isn't it a true statement that I can reorganize the coordinates so that locally it looks flat, but if you go around this loop around the defect, even asymptotically, what he's saying is I'll see a defect.
Yeah. So I'm a little bit confused, though. It's me. You started with some four-dimensional field theory in flat space.
Yep.
And you inserted a defect and discovered that this field theory can no longer be thought of as living in flat space? Or
I would say yes, to orders in 1 over n, yes.
Or is it that the field theory itself, which lives in flat space, has some asymptotic field excitation that that a field theorist would say is some possibly quantum mechanical field configuration far away, but in flat space.
Okay, can we discuss?
Because I don't know what it means to start with a field theory in flat space and then insert an operator and discover that it's no longer a flat space field theory. Can I interpret it by saying that within the field theory, something has happened asymptotically, but still continue to interpret it in terms of the original four-dimensional field theory?
Are you concluding that in flat space, or did you realize you can only do it non-anomalously if you put it in this curve?
I would say non-anomalously you can do it in
curve. Is this supposed to be some kind of operation that you do on the flat space theory? You can't go from a flat space theory to a non-flat space theory within field theory. I don't know what that means.
Well, I would say you're not working with flat space.
He puts a constraint that he wants to work with the supersymmetry.
Right.
And then he finds out that the defect he puts, at least in a naive way, when he assumes there are no additional
This is not an operation in the original field theory.
Well, maybe it's true.
Yeah, it's a different thing that preserves supersymmetry.
It's quite possible.
Let's discuss it later. It's interesting.
There is another interpretation where you think of it as some non-trivial field configuration at infinity with you within.
Right. So maybe it's this interpretation also exists. I'm not sure myself. It's confusing for me as well. So let's talk later. Maybe there is something I want to see more than what I see now. So let me. So then I was saying that the action for the scalars will be complicated, kind of, because the fluctuate. Well, in general, we would say the scalars are fluctuations in the transverse space, but they transform really under diffeomorphisms. I would like to go by the Willebind to go to the flat index, but the Willebinds are not constants, so you have to differentiate them. So there are many equations here, but the outcome is that the action for the scalars, in addition to the kinetic term, will contain something that looks like the curvature of the region of the metric, and some derivatives of the dilaton. So the indices here are slightly different. So IJ is really SU4 indices. I switch from SL6 to SU4 by some Clebsch-Gordan coefficients for simplicity. So we have the gauge field action, which is like more or less usual. The scalar action, which is like the kinetic term, plus the something that looks like the mass term. With the mass depending on the curvature, this is like n equals 4 on, well, similar to n equals 4 on r cross S3. And the action for the fermions also, in addition to the kinetic term, has another term which proportional to the derivative of the axion. So this, if phi is constant, these two terms are really equal, and this is like the usual kinetic term. If the non-abelian extension turns out to be relatively straightforward, I won't write again all the terms in the action, but you replace the derivative, the covariant derivative with respect to connection, by the gauge covariant derivatives, replace the Chern-Simons terms by the non-abelian, and add the usual non-abelian couplings of n equals 4. And it turns out that this is correct. So you can check supersymmetry, and it works. So the field theory side is constructed. So the supersymmetry transformations are basically the same as in flat space up to one term. There is an additional term in the gravitino, which is necessary, because it looks like, because the field theory now has a kind of a mass term. So the variation must also have a mass term, otherwise you find inconsistency. From field theory, it will look like the only supersymmetric solution, the only solution is phi equals 0, this little phi equals 0. But the supersymmetry variations without this term will tell you that there is a Coulomb branch, and these two things cannot be consistent. So now let's look at symmetries. So there are Poincaré supersymmetries, there are obvious bosonic symmetries, but there is no conformal symmetry. Conformal symmetry is really broad. And the surface operator can be, in fact, easily obtained in this theory. And it turns out to be of order type. So the let me do some not very legal operation, but which turns out to be correct, just to save time. So I will rescale the gauge field on the D7 brain with some coupling constant and set alpha prime to 0 and get rid of it, tilde. But it's not really, it's not completely correct, but it turns out to give the right answer. And then the action will be basically, and then the path integral to do is just e to the n equals 4 action with integral over all possible n equals 4 fields. Times various times the chiral fermions, times the e to the defect, and now I want to integrate the defect action. Oh, and the answer is known. What you get, what is called the Wessmüller Witten model at level m, where m is the number of D7 brains. So more precisely, it looks as follows. So we parameterize the gauge field by some u and v. So in two dimensions, it's equivalent, unless, and this is not gauge equivalent to zero unless u equals v. But if it's not, then this is like a different parameterization. And the Wessmüller-Witten model is written in terms of u and v. So it has several terms. Two terms maybe is like the usual Wessmüller-Witten model, but here I'm writing additional term, which is really local. It's written in terms of a plus and a minus. It can be thought as a local counter term. Yes. Well, so this means that when you try to quantum mechanically define the operator, the Dirac operator, because of the anomaly, it will have to redefine in such a way that it will depend on a minus as well. Basically, the anomaly of the Dirac operator depends on a minus. That's why the Wessmüller-Witten model also depends in this sense in a minus, and it produces the correct anomaly. So this operator, it turns out to be of order type. And maybe it's easier than disorder type operators of Buchel-Witten type, which I reviewed before. Maybe not. Then the action and the operator themselves are not gauge invariant, but the product of them is. So the action has the anomaly of the has the variation of the Chern-Simons term, has Chern-Simons terms whose variation will produce something on the defect. And this, and the Vezumina-Witten model also has an anomaly. Under gauge transformation, it gives something like this. And but overall, the everything, when you multiply them together, everything is gauge invariant. Then supersymmetry, it's same story. When we define the naively the action dependent only on A plus and it looks supersymmetric, but when you quantum mechanically want to define it, you'll realize you have to insert, you have to add terms which depend on A minus like this, and supersymmetry is broken. However, again, due to Chern-Simons terms, everything is supersymmetric. You have to vary the Chern-Simons terms and you realize that they give rise to something that looks, that something two-dimensional. And the product, again, is supersymmetric. And the last thing I want to mention here is just again for completeness, what the boundary equations of motion is. And again, so you have to vary the Chern-Simons terms and the operator. And the solution is basically is F equals zero. The equation of motion is so the meaning of the operator in some sense is the boundary condition. It's just the, it says that you're doing path integral with the boundary condition that the connection is flat on the boundary. Okay, so let me now go to holographic duality, then I think where it will be confusing. Because in some sense there exists a probe approximation which you can view as if you're doing in flat space. That's why it's very confusing. So let's start thinking in the probe sort of viewpoint. So we start with D7 brains. We start with D3 brains in type 2B, which is dual to AGS5, string theory and AGS5, process 5. That's the starting point. We introduce D7 brains and tend to ignore the back reaction. So we literally insert it as a probe in AGS, and it makes sense. So we will just say that this parameter is small, comparing to all other to all curvatures and so on to n, m basically much less than n. They don't back react, it seems like. And this seems we can define the probe approximation. So let's study if it makes sense. And it turns out it makes sense. You can really study the details how D7 brain sits in AGS5, process 5. And I'm just only giving the answers. And the answers are the following. So they wrap AGS3, process 5. Then they preserve 8 Poincaré supersymmetries and 8 superconformal supersymmetries. And that's the bosonic symmetry. And once you start separating them, then you break some of them, and it all can be understood from the really studying D7 brain action in AGS5 crosses 5 and all its properties. Yeah.
Was that the reason why you needed to take into account back reaction on the field theory side is that otherwise you would see
well, that's exactly what I'm saying, it's confusing. In principle, the probe approximation here is well defined.
So do you see that anomaly would go away in the probe?
Yes, it seems so. It seems so.
Okay, so why is that confusing then?
Well, once you want to insert include anomaly, it seems you can do it in flat space. From this viewpoint,
that the anomaly disappears in, you know, in this particular scaling limit, so.
Well, that's true. So maybe it's not, but yeah.
He's trying to read the first part of the transparency there. He's trying to explain.
Yeah, okay, so in the field theory, you also can define something like the probe mean. So you can just remove everything and write this edge. And formally, it has the same supersymmetry. So what happens to anomaly if you do it correctly, you scale the fields and do all the usual things, you'll realize it also the next order. So but I thought the confusion was whether how you intrinsically view it. In flat space, deforming it, or you intrinsically not do it in flat space. I'm not sure what the answer is. From various viewpoints, both of them are correct. But yes, you can define the probe approximation in which the anomaly will go away. And you can check the symmetry, supersymmetries, everything seems to be consistent.
Is it? Okay. Can I interpret somehow the probe approximations? There are several ways how I can think about ADS-CFT duality when I deform it by an operator. I can deform the Lagrangian of the theory by this operator.
Yeah.
Or I can ask the question, what's the expectation value of my operator in the region of undeformed theory?
Yeah.
So is there a way how maybe I can think about the probe approximation in this context that I have this disorder, I have this order operator?
Yeah.
And I'm asking what's the value for
I think it's
in the original theory.
I tend to think it's true.
Right. So if that is the case, then I think it's perfectly well defined. I mean, you can ask questions in the supersymmetric theory, which is anomaly free. You ask what would be the value of this operator.
Well, that operator is not gauge invariant. That's the only confusing thing.
Yeah. Okay. It's so it's not local.
Yes. So that's what I'm saying. It's unclear how you would calculate expectation value from field theory. For supergravity, it's obvious. The answer is simple. It's just the area of the of ADS-3. That's
right. But somehow, on a, if I were to use the intuition of local operators,
right,
then it looks like that's exactly.
Yes.
So can I follow?
Yeah.
In the probe approximation in the string theory, I'm sort of thinking that I'm working in a limit where I'm only going to probe distances, or I'm only interested in physics at scales larger than, say, the string scale. Or I'm not sure if it's the string scale or the Planck scale. I mean, and so the back reaction is all confined to a very narrow region.
Okay.
Significant back reaction is only in a very narrow region around the December.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some way in which I can think of this theory in the probe approximation as saying that the theory makes sense if I introduce some short distance cutoff? Somehow that's not how I think of an anomaly. But
I don't know.
I thought the back reaction could be viewed at infinity because of the conical angle.
So I think you should really view this duality statement away from singularities.
Yes.
Sufficiently far away. Yeah, so we can discuss it later. So I'm not sure myself how you exactly what the exact statement is. So I'm not really sure how you calculate the value of the separator in field theory. In perturbation theories, maybe you can ignore the background completely to the leading order in 1/n. It will always contribute to higher order.
I'm not clear why you doubt that. Well, what's the source of the doubt that the Nolangian probe approximation that you can't? I understand the question of orders of limits.
Yes, right. So. Formally, the surface operator also proportional to the same parameter which controls back reaction. But I believe in the Lagrangian limit, you will produce some extra trace which will multiply by n, and the ground won't do it. That's why maybe you can in the Lagrangian limit ignore it. But again, technically, I don't know really how to do it.
But there's also this confusion that Laurent was pointing to.
Yeah.
In the D7 background, there's supposed to be this defect angle.
Yes.
The defect angle is proportional to m, not g squared m or g.
Right.
M, what is m?
M is the number of brains.
Oh, number of seven brains.
Yes.
Yeah. But there's no reason, there's no immediate or obvious reason that that's going to zero in the limit.
I see.
The string coupling is going to zero.
Mm-hmm. Oh, maybe I ignored that. Maybe there is just string. I think there is just string there. I took it right. I forgot right. Yeah, I'm pretty sure there is.
Is there? Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, because I was, I'm pretty sure there is.
I've seen this. Sorry, I thought that there is no G-string there, because there is a finite number of seven brains you can put before you overclose the transfer space. So, so from this perspective, there is no G-string there.
Well, it might be related to how you define the coordinates. Because I was when I said that there is a the seven brains are controlled by some neuromorphic function, it wasn't really neuromorphic, it was in powers of G string text. So maybe there is some, we have to go to right coordinates too.
No, but my claim is that in the right coordinates there are 24.
Yes, that's true.
So and that's the effect we should see.
Well, 24 independent of the coupling constant? That overclose it?
I think so.
Yes.
Oh.
If you
independent of n,
right? I think the way is you need to put a nice global coordinate, something like using the J function instead of local coordinates. And if you use a nice globally well-defined holomorphic coordinate, then you will find.
Well, yes, but the coordinate which I was defined was not neuromorphic.
Right, there was a rescaling.
Right. So
that's why you might get confused by thinking that there is a G string dependent.
Yes, so I'm not sure what the right answer is. So,
there's some deficit angle that you can calculate.
Yes.
Which is proportional to m, but let's take n equals 1.
Right.
And that deficit angle depends. How does it depend on n?
It does. I don't think it depends on n.
It does not depend on n. In the top limit, G squared in
areas.
In what sense is the probe approximation a probe approximation? I think I'm asking the same question.
Yeah. Well, it's a known fact that the seven brain is, strictly speaking, always inconsistent just in terms of the probe approximation.
Well, I think it's the matter what the appropriate coordinate system here. Because for formally, G string M is what controls the solution of the D7 brain. So I think it controls it everywhere. You just have to choose the correct coordinate system so that you always have, the seven brain is given by a neuromorphic function. So which behaves as one with z to the integer power, not just string times integer. And if I'm using what I'm using, maybe the deficit angle will look like the proportional to g string times m. So you have to really go to the right coordinate system, and then you will see the deficit angle is like a.
But there is an implicit saying that I can put as many seven brain into a supergravity background as I want, and I know that is not a right statement.
Yeah.
So that's why whatever coordinates you choose, you should still see this effect if there is a, you know. Well, I guess there is. I think people always knew that you know somehow locally you can think about seven brain as a probe, but
yes.
Globally probably not.
Okay, maybe that's okay. Yeah. So if you allow me to continue. So here I wanted to say that. Yeah, so in the field theory, the fact that we saw that inconsistency at the order GG square M, one can think of it as the back reaction of D7 brain. So yes, there is a question whether you can view it as a probe which back reacts or they intrinsically a new geometry. So let me for simplicity say that it's a real effect of back reaction and they break with some symmetries, in particular they break conformal symmetries. Then you can really find the dual supergravity solution which behaves in some sense the same way. Since I'm running out of time. So let me be brief. It turns out that you can write the system of D3 D7 brain solution in flat space and take the near horizon limit. Usually you have to go do some crazy things like with bubbling geometries, postulate symmetries. But in this case, it turns out you just write the most naive thing and substitute it in the Gravitino and Divatino variations and all that, and it magically works. So we were unlucky in the field theory side. We had to study some crazy field theory, but on the gravity side, we are lucky. There is something simple solution you can write and take the near horizon limit of it. And so the solution is quarter BPS, and when we take the near horizon limit, it turns out there is no any enhancement. It's still everything at the level of 8 supercharges, just like in field theory. And in the near horizon limit, you'll get the metric of this form. So there is AdS3 cross S5 with some warp factor. And there is something dz dz bar, which is also with some also warp factor. When rho is the radius, radial coordinate of AdS3. So, and one can check that this gravity dual solution has the right properties, like the metric on the conformal boundary is exactly what we used in field theory. So this means we really have something that looks like holographic field theory in curved background at the level of quarter BPS. Then you can check symmetries and know that the conformal symmetries are all broken and superconformal symmetries therefore are also broken. And as I said, there is no any enhancement of supersymmetry in the near horizon limit. So you can find the Killing spinner again. And so it has the same conditions. It has some warp factors, which is not very, it's just details. And so let me now conclude. So I decided to think of some surface operators from the viewpoint of microscopic sort of D-brain, from the microscopic D-brain viewpoint. So I started with a system of D-brains and thought what it can really, and considered what it can do. And it leads to some order type quarter BPS surface operators, but it seems the field theory has to be formulated in some curved background, and as we discussed, and there is a confusion how you really think of it. Either a back reaction of D7 brains, or you it's really intrinsically in curved background. And so there is some dual gravity description, and it's interesting, and I think it's an interesting example of holographic duality beyond flat space. And let me finish with this.
Can I make a suggestion
yeah.
for what's missing in your
Yeah, language? Sure.
I'll do it on the blackboard.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm making a guess.
Okay. There's a full box.
Everything is taking place in two dimensions. The other two dimensions are sort of passive. So mm-hmm. you're putting some insertion in, and an insertion is somehow not consistent unless you put a deficit angle in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the deficit angle is just a change in the metric. In fact, it's just a change in the theta-theta component of the metric, rescaling the theta-theta component of the metric.
Mm-hmm.
I can do that in a number of ways. I can distribute the theta-theta component, the change in the theta-theta component uniformly over angle. Or I could just, for example, take a line like this and change the theta-theta component of the metric with a singular delta function term on the line. I can do it in a whole variety of ways, still create the same, squeeze the deficit into a narrow wedge here, or distribute the deficit, it's all the same thing, it doesn't matter how I do it. But basically what I'm doing is I'm changing the g theta theta component of the metric. If I were to do it on a line like this, then I would say that the change in the metric was proportional to the delta function of theta, 0 times probably times the radius, since I want the change in the metric to grow as I go further out. So I can do it in other ways also. I can create. So my point is, how do you vary a field theory with respect to g theta theta or with respect to any g? It's an insertion of the energy momentum tensor. Right?
Okay.
That's the way you vary a field theory with respect to.
Right.
So what I'm suspecting is that you need another factor in the operator,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of a surface operator, which yeah. might just look like e to the I times some number times t theta integrated with r or something like that. The analog of the phase that you put into a charged particle in order to create the electric field. You need something to change the metric. But I think you can do it within the field theory by just saying, OK, to change the metric, all I have to do is vary with respect to operator, variation with respect to metric is the same as
so then the field theory you say will be flat.
Maybe. No, guess it. I'm guessing. Yes.
But sorry, but the Newton constant is zero. The original ADA CFT.
No. It's just is for pure. No, no, constant in there. It's just a numerical number.
No. But you need in order. Right. But in order for that to back react and curve your spacetime, you need to have Einstein-Hilbert term.
No.
How come?
What I'm doing is making a change in the metric in the field theory. You say that the final conclusion is when you put this point in, you'll have to change the metric in the field theory. And I said, okay, change the metric in the field theory. You just do it by varying with respect to G, and that's the same as an insertion of T. With a numerical factor here, it doesn't depend on any.
So you are suggesting that, right, I see. So you're suggesting that it's not that we are lying to ourselves thinking that there is only this surface operator, there is this additional operator, which is still a flat space, absolutely flat space, but that and this will do a supersymmetry and
that's
the
what
job done.
Right. Okay. Right.
Okay.
That's something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. Rough idea. Maybe.
Any more questions? If not, let's thank everyone again.